This is episode 431. Do you believe in climate change? You see, the narrative that has been pushed for years is that cows farting is the reason for our Earth getting hotter and the weather patterns getting all messed up. But I want to challenge that idea because, as it turns out, the way to fix climate change is with more cattle, more cows on more farms, following a specific method of cattle grazing that makes the food taste better and human health improve. And this podcast discusses a current $10 million research project headed up by a professor from the Arizona State University in the USA that is proving more cows on more farms is the answer to sequestering carbon out of the air, easily surviving droughts, and ensuring farming families can actually run a farm that makes them money and gets them out of the massive amount of debt that many farmers are drowning in. So whether you believe in climate change or not at all, that doesn't matter. As long as you believe in human health, humans getting out of debt, or even just having the priority of your burger tasting more delicious when you eat it. If any of that feels relevant or resonates, then this episode is worth listening to. So let's dive in.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? I have a great episode for you here today. Peter and I, we're hanging out here, ready to drop some knowledge, but mostly to inspire you to be a part of this movement. Firstly, though, before we get into that, it's my mission to coach 500 people to achieve real weight loss. And by real, I mean more than just losing the body fat. And we do it without calorie counting, embarrassing weigh-ins, or a forbidden food list. Links to chat with us about how we help and support people with that are down in the show notes below. So scroll, click, book in, chat to you soon. All right, I'm legitimately excited about today's guest, Peter Bick. This fine man, Peter Bick, is currently helping to lead a $10 million research project comparing adaptive multi-paddock grazing, or AMP grazing, with conventional grazing, collaborating with 20 scientists and 10 farming families. This research is focused on soil health and soil carbon storage, GHG cycling, bug and bird diversity, and water retention and storage. Now, you've got to watch this for yourself. Peter's released a new four-part docuseries called Roots So Deep, You Can See the Devil Down There, which he directed, and it's all about the inventive farmers and rebellious out-of-the-box thinking scientists building a new path to solving climate change with cattle, heart, and soil. I've watched it. I took a heap of notes. I've got them with me right here. And honestly, I finished every episode feeling inspired. And so, Peter, let's get into the weeds or into the roots. Welcome to the show, mate.
Thank you, Maddie. I'm very happy to be here. Very, very happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm stoked.
And I'm actually going to be there soon.
Yeah, so you're going to be over here in Australia and even in Melbourne.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. But initially, I actually came across you scrolling. I don't know if I found it on Instagram or somebody else sent it to me, but it was a reel that I saw and you were talking about AMP grazing and the answer to climate change being in the ground and that we need more cattle. And I know that for many people, that would really challenge their understanding. You know, I'm a nutritionist, so there's a lot of vegans out there that, you know, promote the idea that veganism is the answer to climate change. And so after I saw that, I remember saying to some of my team members, I'm like, we've got to get this guy on the podcast. He's awesome. He's so passionate. I loved the video that I saw. So I guess for everybody listening, what is AMP grazing and why do a research project on it?
Yeah, well, it's adaptive multi-paddock grazing. So the animals get moved around a farm in one herd in small paddocks and small areas that they just use electric fence to create. It's very adaptive. You need bigger paddocks this year that you don't have a lot of rain, smaller paddocks. If you've got a lot of rain, you got a lot of forage to eat. And it replicates the way the animals, at least in a North American context, but I'm sure it goes with other continents, the way the bison moved around the Great Plains. They would hit an area all tight together, fairly tight together, relatively speaking, eat half the forage, stomp the rest down. And while they're eating half of that forage, their manure and urine is evenly spread because they're packed together. And then they stomp the rest down that covers the soil, which is the most important thing, soil covered. It's like armor. And then they move on. And then that half-eaten plant just shoots up again with, you know, just grows crazy because it's got all that fertilizer. and it shoots its roots down almost like a mirror, like just, and that action sucks enormous amounts of CO2 out of the atmosphere and brings that carbon into the soil while it burps out, the plant burps out the oxygen for us. Then that carbon in the soil system is the engine. It's the currency for the microbes, and the microbes are the engine. It's all about microbes. Like, it's all about soil health, and healthy soil has diverse microbes, lots of different kinds of plants growing on top. And so amp grazing stokes that on farms of any size. In any ecosystem I've seen, our study is in the Southeast US. So it's sort of a long growing season. It's warm, a lot of rain. And that's where we started. But our science team is now moved up to the Northern Great Plains. Very different ecosystem, very cool, very dry, and a very short growing season. So we're going to see how that compares.
I'm curious, talked a lot about, or with rather, a lot of guests and different people, and I'm a big advocate for the idea of regenerative farming. So I feel like a lot of people listening might really be familiar with that. What's the difference between amp grazing or amp farming and regenerative farming?
I would say they're interchangeable. I would call amp grazing regenerative grazing. I use those words interchangeably. Mm-hmm. And really what it's about is the soil in better shape after you've had your animals on there, or is it in worse shape? Is the bug life in better shape or worse shape? Is the land for grassland birds in better shape or worse shape? And so that's comparing it with conventional grazing, which there's a lot of really talented conventional grazers out there, but a lot of times they'll just let their animals sit in a large paddock for a long period of time, and they sort of pick and choose what they want to eat, and it's not the way the grasslands and those hoofed animals co-evolved. So the land's just not as productive. And that's what our research is comparing right across the fence on three of the five, and then down the street on two of the five, but five farm pairs, 10 families. One side is adaptive grazing. The other side is conventional grazing. And we measure all those metrics I just listed. And that's what, as you know, the series is all about.
Yeah, the series is awesome.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Yeah, very, very, like, it was so well put together. Like, there was no blame. Like, a lot of these sort of documentaries, whilst I very much subscribe to a lot of the documentaries where they're going, they often throw a lot of blame and they're throwing shit at each other. And the energy of what you put together was just, we're here to help everyone. And actually, that reminds me, because you said in there, even if you don't believe in climate change, this is going to help you. And I really liked that, because I think there are a lot of movements in the world of health, wellness, agriculture that are beneficial to all of us as a human species. But because we're attached to these belief systems, we rebel against the idea or the political ideology that's behind what's going on. So if you're open to it, I'd just love to dive into that. Like, what do you mean by even if you don't believe in it? Because you even said on the documentary, which I thought was really awesome too, that some of your science team were a bit skeptical of, you know, some of these concepts as well that were working with you on that project.
One of my science team members, and I think he's evolved over the years, but when we met, it's definitely on that path. But a lot of our farmers, no question, you know, they asked me in that very first episode, are you here because of climate change? And I said, yeah, I sure am. But it doesn't matter why you're here. I look at it, soil health is the North Star. And if you imagine that as a tent with a lot of entrances, then for me, climate change is the entrance. But for a farmer, it might be economics. It's cheaper to use regenerative agriculture for the farmer. They have so many less things they need to buy, like nitrogen fertilizer and equipment and things like that. They're working with nature. It could be water security. You know, the water infiltration is so much better on the regenerative side, so that you're saving the water. It's what Alan Savory and other folks call effective rainfall. Did you get 2 inches of rain on your land? Did it soak in, or did half of it wash away with your soil and wash away chemicals into your neighbor's place? So you could be wanting to have food security, and that's your entrance into soil health. National security. So water security, food security, national security, those are all right there. And there's a lot of farmers, you know, that are very much connected to the stewardship through their own personal faith. They come at this is my responsibility, and that's how they look at it. And that's another entrance to the same exact place. And so I'm coming in through climate change. They might be coming in through faith. And here we are doing the same exact methods for the same results, which is healthy soil and all the stuff that grows from healthy soil. And so for us, I think you can see the poster for Carbon Nation that came out in 2011. And our tagline for that was a climate change solutions movie that doesn't even care if you believe in climate change. Because all those solutions that we were covering made sense, even if you're just a greedy bastard, it made sense just to save money. And that film is where I learned about this type of grazing. And then when I met Alan Williams in 2012, my world expanded exponentially. And because he is one of the pioneers of this method and teaching this method. And he's the guy in episode 4 who comes in and is teaching the conventional. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of all of those factors that you listed in regards to what might bring you into this world of soil health, something that was sort of a little bit shocking to me, and I grew up in a small community farming town, like when I was much younger. And so, you know, I'm not too far away from farms and farmers in sort of socially speaking, but was that with the families you included, especially the conventional farming, like they all had off-farm full-time jobs. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, and I was chatting to my partner because she watched it all with me, and like, how do their lives function? You know, like how do you fit in 40 hours somewhere else plus the travel time and then come home and work what, another 40, 50, 60 hours on your farm? And you know, I guess a normal day job, let's go to the average income of what, say $70,000, $75,000 per year, you know, approximately that you're bringing in from a day job. And it just shocked me that these farmers were struggling so much that they needed to have a day job, which brings in that amount of money in order to just stay afloat. And they've been doing this for years and years and years. So I noticed in an episode, decades or even generations. And I noticed in episode 4, when you were sharing the data with everybody, the pretty much all of them came down to economics. You might be able to get rid of your day job. You might be able to actually work full time on the farm, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that kind of potential is still there. And I don't want to give away the ending for episode 4, but the idea of an off-farm job was so consistent. Yeah. We had a lot of farmers that were teachers that would teach special needs kids, and they were coaches. Like we had two farmers, taught special needs kids and were coaches and had won state championships. Like they were good coaches. And they all loved farming. So the farming was love and the job was to get by. And of course, in the States, we don't have universal healthcare. So a lot of people get their healthcare from their job. And so a lot of the farmers taught me on this job that they were doing their job as much for the healthcare as for anything else economic. And so that got me thinking, you know, we have a thing called the Farm Bill. It's like a big giant piece of legislation, thousands of pages, that gets renegotiated every 4 or 5 years. And it's now in its 6th year. It's like really late. And what if we had healthcare for our farmers? Just like we have, you know, our veterans have healthcare. I've been taught by veterans that healthcare could be better. It's overwhelmed. The system is overwhelmed. And then it all ties together there because veterans who come home with PTSD get on farms working regeneratively and like heal themselves. And we're finding wonderful stories about that. And it's really, I feel better when I'm on a farm. And I think there's actually like physical chemicals coming out of all those plants and all those trees that make me feel better, probably make everybody feel better. Hearing the bugs, hearing the birds, it's an amazing feeling on the regenerative side. On the conventional side, you don't hear that much life. You don't smell that much life. And so the idea of health, soil health, human health, the animal's health, the community's health, all those things are tied together. And as long as we think they're separate, we're just not accurately looking at the truth.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's the same reason, as you know, I've just moved house. We've just moved our, you know, little family out into a much greener area where, you know, we're here in Australia. So we wake up to the sound of kookaburras and it's beautiful. But most people go on a holiday and they go somewhere greener, right? Which the idea being, I want to reduce my stress. I want to feel better about existing as a human being. And most of us go to green, middle of nowhere, or tropical. But the point is, the feature of where we go is nature.
Yeah. And for me, I've lived in the Southwest US for all but 4 years of my adult life. And four of those years of my adult life, I moved back to Kentucky. And I loved it. I loved being around all the trees. I miss them every single day. I lived in LA for 26 years, and then I've been in Phoenix for 11 years. And I miss trees on a daily, hourly, minute-by-minute basis. They make me feel better. But I like a good ocean, too. And so I do like a good swim with my kids. But nature makes me feel better, like just simply put. And of course, the sequoias in California. Have you ever seen those trees in real life?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
So good. And I couldn't get to Sequoia National Park, to my favorite grove, because there were some fires in 2022. And I can't get the data, but it looks like they lost a bunch of them.
Yeah.
And so that issue of the West is drying out, the fires are getting bigger, the trees, like fires that kill sequoia. Sequoia's bark is full of the stuff that we use for fire extinguishers, the healthy stuff we use. Their seeds won't even open unless it's a fire. Mm-hmm. So they're built for fire. But we've allowed the undergrowth in the forests. We've prevented all forest fires, which has allowed the undergrowth to get more rich, more thick. And then when that burns up, when it's so freaking dry, because we're in this 15-year mega drought out here in the Southwest US, the flames are just too much for the trees. And I live in Phoenix. And last summer, the saguaro cactus, you know, the guys with the arms and stuff, it was too hot for them.
Yeah, wow.
They were falling over. And so what's the connective tissue to why I'm on your show? You know, soil health can help with all of these things. The way we manage the land is connected to a lot of these problems. And so I just read that they're doing papers now in the Midwest US, where we've just plowed everything up and we're growing corn and soybeans everywhere. We're having dust bowls as bad or worse as they were in the 1930s. It's just no one's talking about it. And we've changed the weather patterns. There's less rain because rain needs, like, there's more rain when you have more plants growing, you have more evapotranspiration, you have more cycling of water. And all those things are choices, all of it, which is the good news from my perspective, because then we can make choices to get that back. We can do that.
Yeah.
And that's what's crazy for people to think that animals could be part of the solution when grazing has been damaging, no question. And when we get to that industrial scale where we're growing all this corn in such a destructive way to feed all the animals in a concentrated area, all that stuff has its cost, big, big costs. But what these farmers are doing on the adaptive side to make their farms look like this, it's almost the exact opposite, if not the opposite. The only consistent thing is there's cows. But these folks are actually making the land better. It's not less bad. According to our data, it's better. Cooling the earth, not heating the earth. And so every day these cows are on the planet, on that farm, the planet's cooler. Now, obviously, if you have a small amount of farmers doing this, you're not going to get the planet cooler. We need a lot of farmers doing this. And then I think I know we could have impact based on our data. Now we got to do more science. We are doing more science. We're hoping lots of other people do good research and study truly regenerative grazing. A lot of the research that's out there right now, they're not studying regenerative grazing. And some research is actually calling it regenerative grazing or amp grazing, but it's not. And it's, you know, all these sort of cross lines and confusion. What are you going to do, right? It's a new idea. Science is going to punch at it, which is what science does. And it should live through that punching. It should stand up to that scrutiny, you know. And you know, now we're published. We have 13 papers published. We have 1 to 3 more that are going to get published. So it's a lot of work that we put out there. It's an amazing science team. I'm not a scientist. I'm a slight wrangler of them at times, but they're, it's a remarkable team of people that came together, very interdisciplinary, you know, very much working across their own specialty and realizing the grazing guys realizing, whoa, the bugs have so much to do with my cattle. And I had no idea, like that kind of cross pollination is happening all over the place on our team. And then they're all doing amazing work since we did a lot of our work already. It's a pretty amazing project.
You mentioned before, like the dust bowls being as bad as the 1930s. I'm curious if you could just give us a bit of background for people listening. Like, how did we get to a place where we needed to figure out how the soil and the earth behaves naturally? Because what I think about is being a nutritionist and in this world of, you know, I was a medical scientist once and in a hospital, and now I'm very much mostly on the side of natural health, naturopathy, Chinese medicine, that kind of thing. And the common thread that seems to be happening, whether it be agriculture, whether it be medicine, whatever, wherever the renegades are or the rebellious people that are saying, no, we actually knew how to do it, you know, 5,000 years ago. And we've gone through this industrialization where we kind of destroyed everyone's health and the earth's health and all of these things. But now we're using science to prove that what naturally happened before was actually right, which is like a big insult to Mother Nature, right? It's like, you had it right and we thought we could do it better and it turns out we were wrong. But
well, we grew so much that I don't know, man. I understand why people went down the road towards industrial food production. I get that. I really do understand it because you're trying to grow more food for less money.
Yeah, of course.
And we got really good at growing vegetables and meats for a lot less money. You notice I didn't call it food necessarily, because the nutrient density of all those foods grown with all those inputs is going down and down and down. So you're not even actually getting full nutrition from the food grown in the industrial system. So yeah, it's cheap to produce, but the cost to the land, the cost to rural communities, where most of the money sucked out of the rural communities in these industrial systems, so they're just dying, and the cost to the whole ecosystem of the farm, the cost to the farmers, the cost to the ingesters of those foods, it's massive. And so I was taught by this guy at a food co-op in Albuquerque. He just was saying how his family said that all this regeneratively grown food, he was spraying it, keeping it fresh, you know, how expensive it was. And he said, well, how much are you spending on meds? Yeah. And his family would sort of stop talking then. And he taught me that if I put all my healthcare costs, whether the government's paying for it or not, and my food costs in one bucket, then that cheap food becomes very expensive, right? And the same stuff's happening with soils. If we leave the soils open, exposed to wind erosion, one big wind event on an exposed field that doesn't have anything growing in it, it could take off tons and tons of carbon-filled soil off your farm, like per hectare, per acre. It's crazy how much it does. And when you have your soil exposed like that, I just don't know the Celsius necessarily. I'll just do Fahrenheit. Microbes stop working around 100 to 105 degrees Fahrenheit, which I think is right around 40 degrees centigrade.
You're right.
And then after that, they die. And there was measurement in Texas on exposed soil a summer and a half ago that was 170 degrees. And a friend of mine, Alan Williams, has seen 180 degree soil.
Whoa, that's like 80 degrees Celsius.
We're right next to it. With covered soil, it's 75 or 80 degrees. Like right next to it. Same sun, same amount of time, everything the same except exposed, covered. And so that microbial system that we need to be drawing nutrients out of rocks, out of the soil system, and putting into the plant through the root system, that's vibrancy. That's how we get nutrient-dense food, is from that microbial community. That's what I was saying. They're the game. They're the game. And so the animal that's eating nutrient-dense food is getting those plant nutrients, the phytonutrients, and then passing that on to us if we choose to eat the animals or not. But all the folks who are vegan, all those massive, massive industrial farms that are growing their vegetables and their fruits. I guarantee you, when they're plowing, the carbon, the global warming of those systems eclipses the methane, of the warming of the methane from the cattle. It's a much more warming event when you're plowing those fields. And so folks aren't talking about plowing fields or not plowing fields. That's really important data to get right at the top. And you can have organic farms that are gorgeous and the soil's covered all year round. You can have organic farms where the soil's like powder and the soils are never covered except for that one row of plants. And the destruction of a field with nothing growing on it, the destruction of soil that's exposed, should make us all feel the same way we feel when we see a seagull covered in oil from an oil spill, because it's a solar spill. It's really, really, really destructive. And if we just do that one thing, if we get all the farms to use cover crops and grow stuff that's always got a root, a living root in that soil, feeding the microbial system, that's a massive step in the right direction. And so you think about scale, you think about this is so overwhelming, you think about all these problems. Those are real solutions. And the farmers do better when their soil is covered. Their farm is more productive, right? And so it's not a sacrifice for farmers to make our lives better. It's a benefit for farmers to make their lives better, which then do make our lives better. And so if someone's doing all that cool work and they're not worried about climate change, I'm cool with that. I'm worried about climate change, but I'm also equally worried about soil health. Mm-hmm. And I have scientists, friends who are super sharp, who feel that humans are going to be dealing with poor soil problems ahead of climate change problems.
Yeah.
So I know I just riffed on a lot of stuff from that Dust Bowl question, but it's all connected. It's all connected to our health.
Yeah.
To your health, to mine. Yeah.
No, I think it's awesome. I think everything you just said is awesome. And the thing that sort of popped up for me as you were talking about that was this idea that I thought about when I was watching the docuseries was the thing with cover crops and having grass and weeds and all of these things growing in a paddock. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that I thought, I wonder what percentage of the thought process, and this would probably be impossible to actually tease out, but is walking out the front door of your house on your farm and as a conventional farmer, looking at your paddocks and being proud that they are clean, organized, mowed, like, and as a driver by, you're like, oh, that's a beautiful field of, you know, yellow canola flowers or whatever it is. Whereas you drive past an amp grazing field or a regenerative farm, and it looks a bit like a mess. It looks like the crazy person's house who doesn't care about what's going on, you know. And so
pretty shaggy. Yeah.
Totally. So it just popped up in my mind, like, I wonder how much of this is the visual element of saying I'm a good farmer because look at what I've created. It's so organized and structured and clean and crisp.
Oh yeah. That's definitely a piece of it, because people have been taught to feel proud of a field that looks like a lawn, that looks like a golf course, that looks like a clean meadow, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, where you can't hide a golf ball.
Yeah.
That kind of beauty. And to me, before I was trained in all this stuff, that looked gorgeous to me. It did. And it still does, right? I love a good lawn.
Yeah, humans, you know, we like patterns. We like symmetry, yeah. right?
I mean, I watch soccer. So, I mean, talk about a lawn with patterns and symmetry, right? But what happens is, the farmer, I think a lot of stuff sort of happened by accident for a lot of the regenerative farmers as they were growing into stuff. They would see their animals eat something that they thought was a weed that they would have sprayed, but they're eating it and their animals are healthy. So then they're going, wait a second. And the animal's choosing to eat that, not avoiding it, right? And so that they start putting those things together. There's a great story. This is a dairy farmer in South Carolina, sort of the Southeast US, a guy named Tom Tratham. I know he's passed away. He was just like the biggest milk producer in South Carolina, but the industry that he was in was so bad And then bad weather happened and had to do this big hay lift from the Midwest to the Southeast US just to feed the animals. And he was going out of business. He literally came home and told his farmhand, look for another job.
Yeah, well.
That night, his lead cow, sort of the leader of his herd, kicked open the fence and went and ate his junk field, like the place where all the weeds were growing that he just never even paid attention to.
Yeah.
Right? She led the way. And he milked her that next day, and her milk was amazing, better than he'd ever tasted before. And he's like, what the heck? And then he sent them on there again after they'd eaten half. He sent them on there and made them eat it all the way down, and it tasted bad again. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh. And because of that moment, not only did he not go out of business, but he became the biggest organic milk seller in South Carolina. Because his animals told him, we want to eat that stuff. And animals can choose what they know what they need. They can balance their diet if given a whole lot of choices, a whole lot of choices of what they're eating. Just like I would, I mean, you tell me, but the more diverse a human's appetite, wouldn't that equal a diverse gut microbiome?
Yeah.
I don't know, but.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the rebuttals to the extreme diets like carnivore, is that there's a lack of biodiversity. Because once upon a time, if we were carnivorous, we would have eaten the intestines of another animal. We don't eat the intestines anymore, which is where you would get the introduction of the biodiversity out of another animal's gut. But because we only eat the muscle meat, we don't get the biodiversity.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And again, our gut biome, the soil biome, the cow's rumen, biodiversity seems to be like the healthiest choice. It helps you when, if something goes wrong, you've got an army in there of different types of critters to go after that and balance it out.
It reminds me, what you're just talking about reminds me of Fred Provinza's work.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I thought so. Do you want to just sort of go over it for those listening?
Yeah. So Fred Provinza is just an awesome human being. He's emeritus from Utah State, and all of his work, a lot of sheep, some cattle, but he would allow the animals to eat whatever they wanted, and he would sort of take away some part of their diet, like he would take away all their protein, and then watch in a field how they would eat more protein. Like they would balance out their diet if he sort of manipulated and pulled this lever and pulled that lever. And so, you know, that these sheep would go for these areas where these animals that nest in the ground, I forget what kind of animal, but their urine had what the sheep were lacking. And they would just go hunt out these little ground nested stuff. And, you know, obviously it's not good for those ground nesting animals, but they can build more. And maybe they used it when they were abandoned. I don't know. But Fred's work showed that animals have the ability to balance out their diet if given the opportunity. In his book, Nourishment, which I highly recommend, then asks, do we still have that ability ourselves? Like when we crave something, what's that? What is that, right? Mm-hmm. If we're craving something of health, obviously food's so designed and manipulated now, they can create craving in the lab, right? And then a guy who studied under Frez, a guy named Stefan von Vliet, who's working a lot right now. And Stefan's work is all that nutrient density in the food. So he's sort of the tip of the spear for that whole kind of research. I'm sure he's not the only guy, but he's the guy that I know and respect. And he's out there measuring the nutrient density of all of these foods and seeing that when an animal has a lot of choices of good, rich diet out in the field, their meat actually is much more nutrient dense. You know, go figure. It makes sense, but people, it's like people are so used to the industrial model. And they call it conventional, right? It's a conventional model. I think it should be called the chemical model.
Yeah.
And I think at some point, regenerative farming, that could be conventional. Mm-hmm. Like that's the conventional thing. And so, yeah. So Fred Provinza, he's great. He's awesome.
Yeah.
We're building our first, our podcast. It's called The Peter Bick Show. And Fred's one of the guys in season one.
Oh, amazing. It was awesome.
Yeah, he's really good.
Yeah, that's really cool.
He's so in tune, you know? And so I speak to him, I feel better. I just feel better. He's like going into the woods. That's what a conversation with Fred Provenza is like. So he's part of my nourishment.
Yeah.
He really is.
That's beautiful. I love that. And for me, you know, in the work that I do, I really loved this idea of that nutritional wisdom, which you're describing, that, yeah, we innately, cows, goats, sheep, and possibly and probably humans, once we get, you know, out of all the marketing stuff that's thrown at us, we have our own nutritional wisdom and go towards foods. And they did a bit of a study many years ago with kids, you know, little kids going towards different foods that they needed based on how they were feeling, whether they were sick. And this idea that we eat, and the cows do the same thing, but they can't do the same thing in a paddock that only has one species of grass in it, and they're only eating the same thing over and over. And I guess the human reference is like the carnivore one we just mentioned, right? This is a lack of biodiversity, a lack of nutrition going in for the cows in this instance. And the consequence for that is that these farmers end up spending a lot of money on medications, B12 injections, like all sorts of different things that go into the cows to make them what they should have been naturally, which my understanding is from watching your docuseries, is that the amount of injections and medical needs that these cows have afterwards, after going amp grazing, plummets to almost zero.
Yeah, 10% is the number I hear over and over again. 10% of the medical bills, the medical costs of what they used to spend when folks start working with nature. And I've seen that in all sorts of ecosystems, not just where we did our research. And it's the same number every single time. And so, you know, that's data, right? Yeah. That's data. Like if I'm in a desert in New Mexico, or I'm in a flat land in Kansas, or I'm in very warm and very wet Cornwall or Devon in the UK, every farmer I talked to talked about they now spend 10% of what they used to spend on medical bills by having their animals working with nature. And a lot of it's diversity of eating. A lot of it is. And we just posted something this week. We met a farmer, and she grazes, she lives 6 hours north of Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. So she's way north. Mm-hmm. And they plant, one of the many things they plant is they plant a cover, like an eight types of plant mix in the spring. They harvest it in the fall, and they leave it in rows. They don't bind it up or bale it or anything. They just leave it out there. And then when the snows come, the animals then graze those rows happily. Like they're healthy. They're not in a barn all winter where if you get manure on their fur, they actually get cold. They don't have that air pocket of healthy fur, which is part of the insulation. So they're actually healthier out in the snow. They're their own little snow plows, and they know exactly what to do. And it's so much cheaper for the farmer and less time. That's what these things. I'm not a farmer. I'm not a scientist, right? That's the first line of the freaking movie. All the decisions I hear from the farmers that are working with nature, it's like every step saves them money. And that's why I don't care whether they're concerned about climate change or not. It's happening anyway. That's a big tent. Soil health is a big tent. You come in where you want. It's all good. It's all good.
We can all hang out together.
Yeah. And we do. And we're seeing that with the response we're getting on social media and from the screenings and stuff. We're getting a very wide swath of people all coming into that tent of soil health and working with nature across the political spectrum. And from meat eaters to vegans, across that eating spectrum. Mm-hmm. You know, you were talking about how like if you're only eating one thing, how wouldn't you need more biodiversity, right? Wouldn't you need more biodiversity? And I would guess that carnivore diet, that's the keto diet, right? It's the same. They're interchangeable.
No, the keto also includes things like avocado and like dairy. Oh, okay. Like it's still quite high fat. As long as it's high fat, it doesn't matter where it came from. But carnivore is exclusively meat. And then there's more extreme, which is the lion diet, which is only lamb and beef.
Got it. And so I would think humans, you know, you're not always going to find the animal, right? So you're going to start, they had to have eaten other stuff. They had to have eaten other stuff in between the hunts, right? I'm guessing. But even so, you know, we, I feel like, and tell me if this is accurate, you're much more into, you know, much, so much more than I do on this. Some people probably do, their bodies probably do kind of work better if they eat a lot of meat. Some people's bodies probably do work when they eat very little meat or none, right? We're a whole bouillabaisse of humanity.
Totally agree.
So I know for me, I stopped eating meat and chicken for about 5 years from when I was 16 to like 21. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of slowly went back to chicken. Then I slowly went back to meat. And really the time that I crave meat is when I've done a big hike in a national park. Do a big giant hike. And I'm like, I could use some red meat right now, you know? And I just gave blood last Saturday. And I was like, man, you know what? I think some red meat, you know, replenished the iron.
Yeah.
And I also ate spinach. I also ate a lot of spinach because that's iron as well. So I don't have as diverse a diet as I need to. That's for sure. I know that. I need to have a lot more stuff on a daily or weekly basis. Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, no.
I get in my little ruts of just grabbing the avocado and grabbing the cheese and oatmeal for breakfast, you know, so I'm just sort of.
Do you want to know how to lose weight without counting calories or needing to use restrictive diets? Turns out the answer is on Instagram. You might be interested to know that over 70% of our paying clients begin their journey with a weight loss goal. Most of them achieve this goal without fad diets and without calorie counting. And in the process, they also rewire their brains to stop craving sugar and they stop their secret binge eating sessions without the need to use loads of willpower. Why does what we do work? Because the fat that you want to lose, it isn't just about the calories you're consuming. It's actually wild how differently we do things. We work on your mind and your body gets better. And I think more people need to know about how we can do this for you too, which is exactly why I'm back on Instagram as The Real Weight Loss Coach. If you want to know how to really drop the weight that's been holding you down, how to keep it off, and to stay healthy long into the future, then follow me on Instagram. The link to my profile is in the show notes below, or you can search for me on Instagram by typing in The Real Weight Loss Coach. Give me a follow and I'll chat to you in the comments and the DMs over there.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're very accurate. I think, yeah, I'm someone that I'm kind of like 60 to 70% meat. I feel best. And if I'm eating, you know, even if it's a whole real food, organic, clean, if I'm eating lots and lots of curries and vegetables and stuff like that, I start to feel a bit brain foggy and groggy. It's just like I've got too many carbs in my system. So, but at the same time, if I go too extreme and I do go a bit too keto, I start thinking, oh, I'd love some broccoli. Like, so right. It's that nutritional wisdom popping up, you know, and starting right. to crave what I need.
And so for me, a lot of times when I travel, I'll eat whatever the frick I want and have a sweet tooth. And like over the holidays just now, I was eating all the breads I wanted. I was eating all the sugar I wanted. And I had indigestion every day. Mm. You know, so I'm taking the Tums to sort of level that off. But when I go to bed, I my body's talking to me, but I'm like, I'll talk to you after the first of the year.
Well,
and I gained weight too. I gained a bunch of weight real quick. So it's not a mystery.
Yeah. That's one of the, I guess, the entry points for me into the conversation about nutrition to regen farming and amp grazing is because my kind of sort of position in the world of health is that my opinions and ideas and philosophies come from a desire for human health, irrelevant of morals or politics or ethics. I'm like, this is the information I believe is best for the individual to be healthy or the human species to be healthy. And that's why I love the idea of all of your work and what you're putting out there and the amp grazing and the regen grazing, because the nutrient density, the nutrient per calorie like ratio goes way up. And as you're talking about, a lot of those breads and refined grains and things that come off monocrop farms that are covered in pesticides and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, the nutrient profile is much lower and then goes into a factory where it rearranges the nutritional, you know, what was natural into something that you're going to have one of and then crave 10 more. So yeah. I love that these animals are getting healthier and bigger. And I think in my notes, I've got, I think it was $400 more per cow that the amp grazers were selling for.
Yeah, that was self-reported data that the regenerative farmer was selling their cow at sale or their steer at sale. It was $400 more per head.
Yeah, that excites me. And you can, like, I order regen meat, like delivered to the house. You can taste the difference. It's so much better.
Oh yeah. So for anyone listening who's really thinking about health, the grass-fed, grass-finished meat has a yellow fat. And the grain-finished sort of feedlot beef, or grain-finished, even if it's not a feedlot, has a white fat. And so I'm not going to get into all the chemicals of that, because that's not my skill set. But that's a big difference just visually. Mm-hmm. You can tell something's going on. And maybe there's exceptions to that, but that's what I'm seeing consistently, at least in the States. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of the first times I fed my son, as I was learning about this, we got some meat from this farm called Ranny Ranch in New Mexico. And I cooked it for my son, who was, let's see, 10. Mm-hmm. And when I smelled the meat cooking, it smelled like my grandmother's house. And that would have been decades ago. And his eyes lit up. I didn't tell him where it was from. I didn't tell him anything about it. And he's like, "Where'd you get this? This is different." Like, his 10-year-old mouth knew something was different. Mm. And so what is that built-in knowledge that Fred Provenza talks about, right? And is it more nutrient dense? Yes, it is. And so if that's the case, then that's nature making healthy food taste better, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I would also argue, without much evidence, but I would also argue that a 10-year-old's palate, tongue reaction and response is more reliable than those of us that have been here for a few decades, conditioned by social media and drugs and alcohol
and
philosophies and ideas. It's like, you know, a 10-year-old's probably much more in tune with that nutritional wisdom.
Yeah. And I think in France, they won't eat steak that hasn't the animal hasn't been on the earth for 4 years.
Yeah, interesting. I didn't know that.
The profile, the if it's nutrients or if it's flavor profiles or both. Mm-hmm. And you know, in the industrial system, I think those animals are a year and a half to 2 years old when they're put down. And of course, they're getting so much fatty grain, and a lot of them are getting indigestion. Like I get in the holidays, they got acidophilus, and they have to have medicine for that. Mm. And in our study, the grazing on the adaptive side, like I said earlier, it's not less bad. They're drawing down so much carbon because they're able to produce so much forage that it's actually a cooling event. Even when you factor in the methane warming and the nitrous oxide warming, there's so much CO2 coming down the system, it eclipses the warming of those two real greenhouse gases.
Yeah.
And it's a net sink. And the farmers can double or triple, sometimes even quadruple, the carrying capacity of their same land. And so I was talking to a farmer in Missouri when we were making the short films that led to this, and he said he doubled his carrying capacity, and he likened it to he just got a free farm.
Nice.
Because he now could grow twice the amount of food on the same exact land with the same exact rainfall.
Yeah, that's incredible.
So, yeah. Those are the inclinations, those are the indicators that just shows if it's more productive. And then it's got more nature on it, which mm-hmm. is what our farms, what we see in our research, just a lot more nature on these farms, making the farmer more money. All the water sinks into their soils. It doesn't wash off. And so it's all these indicators, all of them just start filling up that column of mm-hmm. why is this a good idea? And it's a pretty long column of why this is a good idea.
Oh, absolutely. I think when I finished watching all of them, the thing that hit home for me, because I remember being a kid when we were not allowed to have showers on every second day, and you weren't allowed to water the veggie garden or anything like once a week, maybe if you were lucky, and they only allowed water for this hour to this hour. So I remember being in drought, and the water retention in the soil, that the data that you guys got from that, and being drought resistant or being able to survive droughts as a result of the water retention rather than the fields flooding and all of that water disappearing into neighboring lands. That really hit home for me because, you know, it makes me there's a lot of ideas about how humans lasted this long, you know, on the earth, because there's been so many disasters and droughts and ice ages and different things. And that starts to introduce ideas that have been around for a long time that happened naturally that would have inherently been a part of our story, you know, as to how we got here. Because no doubt there was long droughts thousands and thousands of years ago. How did we get through those?
Yeah. Well, the indigenous people in Australia, they did such great work with their with the way they managed water. And I'm pretty sure the author's last name is Massey, and I'm pretty sure his book is called The Call of the Reed Warbler. This is an Australian rancher who tried and successfully recreated these indigenous waterway methods in Australia to help make his land much more resilient in drought and to keep all the water and to keep it there. And in the US, it's like mimicking beaver, right? If you mimic the way the beaver are doing stuff, then you're going to retain the water on your land. And it's just like, how much can we mimic nature? We know what happens when we really mess up nature, when we kill major species of animals and pull them away, when we let animals just roam and graze everything and keep it really short. We know the result of that when we plow and plow and plow and plow. And yeah, there's a lot of industry and a lot of systems and a lot of inertia to keep all those systems going, but there's a cost, and it's a big cost, and it's happening now. The bill's being paid now. And all the big food companies, you know, the ones I've spoken with anyway, they know. They know they don't have a resilient supply chain of food. And so they're listening to Alan Williams. They're listening to Gabe Brown. They're like, what can you guys help us with? But it's still a big lift from those six or seven people in those big companies that are listening versus the rest of the company necessarily, right? Mm-hmm. And people change jobs, they move to different companies. So there's listening. It's just, how do we get to scale? How do we get to scale, right? And so one of the two reasons we did this research to find out if amp grazing was indeed a benefit, and if it was, what was beneficial, what wasn't beneficial. All the metrics we measured show that it is beneficial. So that's pretty cool. That's pretty amazing, actually.
Yeah.
And we have real rigorous scientists on our team who are skeptics, who are scientists, who are questioning. So it was pretty amazing. But then a lot of farmers don't yet know really about soil health. They've just never been taught about soil health. And so we need to get that knowledge out. So we made the movie, we made the series Roots So Deep so that we could help this messaging happen, right? And that's what we're doing right now. And so we're releasing our series ourselves. Eventually we'll get a good streaming deal. We know that's coming, but right now there's sort of like the hardcore folks everywhere that want to watch it. It's not tons of people, but it's not small numbers either. And so we've been getting all these requests from Australia. So we're going to make it available in early February. Probably I land on February 8th. So I think we're going to make it like the day I get there and make it available in pretty much the world at that point. It's available in the US and Canada and the UK and Africa right now. I think we're just going to open it up for the world. And then our social media, like we put little bits of the film up there and we put people's responses to the film up there and little bits of other stuff that we've made. And we're up to 100 million views on our social media campaign that's about a year and a half in. And we've got over 650,000 followers. And I say this because these followers, the folks who are with us, it's, I mentioned, it's across the political spectrum. It's across the diet spectrum from vegan to carnivore. It's also across the rural to urban spectrum. So we have farmers. There's folks in rural United States that aren't farmers, of course, folks in rural parts of everywhere that aren't farmers, folks that are, but then a whole lot of folks from the cities that are consumers, right? And so, you know, people ask, you know, what's your audience for this series? And, you know, we really were focused on farmers for the first year of our campaign, no question, absolutely. But now I think it's just simply people who eat food. That's our audience. And how can we be helpful? Because we know it's better for the farmer. We know it. And so now I want to help as many farmers as possible. And the farmers are going to help us. Yeah. Right?
Everybody benefits.
Everybody.
Yeah. Everything you just said, I think, is awesome. And, you know, that's why we're here, because I want to help more people be exposed to this idea and your work. Yeah. And I think you execute it so well. That just leaves the viewer, the you know, just inspired or excited, or at the very least curious.
I like that.
And something that resonated with me in amongst all of that, which is I really liked that you included this, because it's kind of the stuff that politically most people wouldn't include, was that you had a scientist on your team who was on the show that talked about his challenges with some of the places you were getting the funding from. And I resonate with that as somebody that used to work in a cancer hospital that left on the grounds of believing that I was not a part of a good system that was not helping people. Yeah. And that requires, you know, we've got over 450 podcasts where people can understand that story. But the point is that I really resonated with that idea, because he left working from the USDA because he had similar feelings about that organization not doing the right thing. And you guys got, you know, I think it was $4 million from McDonald's. And he was really challenged by the fact he was working on a project that was funded by McDonald's.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, when we were fundraising, so that was a big part of my responsibility from 2014, when the team first got together, to see, hey, is this an idea? Is this a good idea? Is this a team? Mm-hmm. To when we hit the ground in the fields in 2018, we spent all that time fundraising and designing the project. And I originally was going after oil money. That was my goal, because I wanted the oil industry, because we were seeing you could close the carbon cycle, drill down a kilometer, use the oil, which I use. I fly, I drive, I've got all sorts of plastic stuff in my office. I'm not innocent in that whole use of oil game. I try to use as little as possible, but I fly. So it's like, right? Yeah. I mean, I do have solar panels and I do have electric cars, so photons into my car, that's good. I know there's a carbon footprint to the manufacturer, all that stuff. But we thought if we could get the fossil fuel industry to pay for this research to see if it's of value, to see if it's a carbon sink and a greenhouse gas sink, they made all the money from getting the carbon up there. We spent it. We gave it to them. Why shouldn't they pay for getting it back down? Why shouldn't they use the carbon cycle to close the carbon cycle? And so a friend of mine, his name's Russ Conser, he was working at Shell back in 2013 when we got introduced. He's a big part of this project, such an amazing thinker. He was retiring after 32 years there. And he had his epiphany where he realized, as an exploration guy for Shell, a kilometer down, if you found rock that was 5% carbon, that was the spot. Mm-hmm. And if we have soils a meter down that are 5% carbon, you're thriving. Like, you're thriving. And when he had that epiphany, shared it with us, that's when he had that, like, it's like a cycle.
Yeah.
We can take this old carbon, cycle it back down to soil where it's really, really missing and we need it. And so I understand people's allergy to taking corporate money for anything. But the way we looked at it was, if these big companies want this, if we can get big companies to want that, healthy soil system, amazing forage, birds, bugs, healthy farmers, healthy animals, then we have a shot, right? Then we have an actual shot. If we can convince them through whatever, if it's their own selfish ways or whatever it is, right? And so when McDonald's came on board as a potential funder, we presented, it fit what they were looking for. They feed 1% of the planet.
Wow.
Every single day. So if we could get the entire McDonald's system to go for that, that's significant. Will we win? And when I say we, I mean humans. And when I say win, I mean the planet getting healthy. I don't know. But that's been our maneuver. That's been the way we've chosen to go this way. We actually didn't run from that money. We wanted that money. And so John Lundgren, the scientist you're mentioning from episode 3, who has a real hard time accepting that money, he and I have a real heavy conversation. And we filmed it. I mean, I didn't expect that conversation when it happened, quite frankly, but I knew something was up. I could feel something up for him. And so I I would hear him say stuff and I'm like, oh, that's what's going on. Mm-hmm. That's why you're unhappy right now. And it just made sense. Let's have that conversation in the movie, right? This is a real conundrum. It's a real challenge to get industry money to actually have it sort of not be manipulated.
Yeah.
Right. And we presented a proposal. They said, yes, we'll do that proposal. They didn't choose a scientist. They didn't choose a farm. They didn't choose a method. They can't even read our research before it's published. I would let them if they wanted to, but they don't have that right to change anything. Mm-hmm. They didn't have any kind of consideration to where they could change our movies at all. It was very open, very open. And so, which took a lot of guts for the four people at McDonald's who supported this work. You know, it's about the single people at these big companies. It's not, we didn't get McDonald's to fund us, although McDonald's did fund us. You know, it was those four people who made that choice back in 2016, when not a ton of people were talking about soil health and carbon and regenerative practices. They were, but it wasn't like in the popular culture. So I'm grateful for them for doing that. And you know, we're not done. We got to get all the rest of our papers published. And they're kind of tired that it's taken this long, to be honest. And I understand. I get it. I really do get it.
Yeah.
But that's our point. That's why we went for corporate monies, because we want to help change the way things are going. And that was our method of going for change. And again, I don't know if we're going to be successful or not, but that's the gamble we took.
Well, I think in a world where we live and die by our political beliefs or our social media statements, the thing that including that shows, and just the way that you execute the communication, is that we can evolve, we can change, and not be ridiculed for it or not be shamed for it. And that, yeah, we're just all on this learning journey and of life, trying to figure out how to do things better. And I think that, you know, social media's pros and cons like everything, but often we get fixed into a silo of beliefs or algorithm ideologies. And it's so easy to get stuck in that world. So I think it's good that you included that, because it shows that there is conflicting things going on in people's heads that are involved, and that there's overlaps of our ideas but you can still make it work.
Potentially, right? I think we're still, you know, the jury's still out how big the scale and how much the companies want this to happen. We have good data to say it's a good idea, and we want to help everyone go down this road, because it's better for the land, it's better for the farmers, it's better for us as consumers. And I think it's going to be better for the companies. I think it's going to be better for the companies, because they do not have a resilient food supply chain right now.
Yeah.
They don't. And they're food companies. And they have stockholders and they have, you know, they have investments, all the employees there. And so it's important, right? It's important to the future of the companies if they're going to be promoting resilient food systems. Well, here we go. We've got some ideas. Let's go there. Let's take this to the next level. Let's get 10,000 farmers trained in these methods. Let's get 100,000 farmers trained in these methods, and let's see how they do. Let's see how they do. The pockets are deep enough to cover that kind of cost. Absolutely. Right? And so what, 1,000,000 is a million, right? 1,000,000. So if we got 100,000 farmers, 10 million. If we got $100 million, how many farmers can we change for $100 million while continuing to do the science and the research, right? Because there are people that want to pay farmers fees. They want to pay farmers for the carbon. They want to pay farmers for the ecosystem services. We've got to be able to measure that cheaply.
Yeah.
And how do we measure that cheaply? We keep innovating. And you innovate and you get more data by being on more farms. And so if we can get all those 100,000 farmers to change and then measure it all, then we've really got a great data set to help create that whole ability to give farmers that piece of income that could really make the difference. But the benefit for farmers, the biggest benefit, according to the folks I study, is the doubling, tripling, and quadrupling of how much food they're producing on their land with the same rainfall. That's the big benefit. These sort of ecosystem services benefits, like can you pay people to have wildlife refuges, refuge spots, like for grassland birds? Can you pay farmers for water cycling, right? You know, can you pay farmers for their soils being more healthy? And so it's got more carbon in the soil system than we have in the atmosphere now. We're switching it back down. Can that be measured? Can that be the durability of that? How much capacity can you have of that carbon in the soil? It's not even about how long each molecule lasts. It's how much more carbon can that system run at one time? So inherently, you'll have less carbon up here if you've got more running down here. And markets aren't really thinking about that sort of capacity thing. Yeah. That's what my friend Russ Consters also taught me, is that capacity in any given moment. That's the goal. How much carbon's rocking through that economy below ground at any given moment? And it doesn't matter that little molecule is going to last 10, 20, or 30 years. It's the whole thing just rocking. And, you know, and these farmers that are cycling water so well, that hamburger is not taking all these gallons and gallons and gallons of water to produce that nutrient-dense hamburger. That system is actually saving water. It's not wasting water. It's actually utilizing water, recharging these aquifers that are so drained. I don't know what the situation is in Australia, but our aquifers here, they're all just getting drained. And that doesn't come back. You don't get a recharge. That's a long cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. Long cycle. Well, because we've got everybody super excited about the work you're doing, or at least I'm hoping that I'm transferring my excitement to everybody listening. Where can everybody find you online? Where can they get Roots So Deep? Because I recommend it to everyone.
I appreciate that. So you can rent Roots So Deep at rootssodeep.org. It's right there. Boom. You can catch all of our social media. Our handle is @CarbonCowboys. And so on all the social media channels, @CarbonCowboys. And we'd love to hear from folks. We want to aggregate as many stories as possible. We collaborate with all sorts of groups when they have a good story. We get their story popped up there. And now that our numbers are so good, we actually can help other people get more people to their site, which is really cool. So like farmers can, we have one farmer, she had this, her name's Anne. And her husband, Bob, they found out their burger had this great nutrient density through this company called Regenified. And she made a 6-minute video just out in the field eating her burger and talking about the nutrient density. And then we took and made 60 and 90 second pieces of that. And we posted it and they had like 1 million views and they sold out of all the stuff in their freezer.
Oh, that's great, like, man.
We can do that, right? How many times can we do that? That's it. It's economics, right? The farmers have to make money. Yeah. They have to make a living. They deserve it. And let's help them.
Yeah, man. I'll put all of those links down below for everybody. Please. So scroll down into the caption, into the show notes, click the links, get into the world of Roots So Deep. And Peter, it's awesome. I love it. I'm a fan, obviously. But to finish up this conversation, and I know there's probably 1 million things that you could say with all the work you've done, but what is one piece of health information you wish more people knew about?
Soil health, keeping the soil covered. If everyone knew that if they see uncovered soil, that's a disaster, that's the piece. Keep the soil covered with plants at all times. That's the game.
Amazing. Thanks so much for being here, Peter. You're an amazing human, and let's do it again.
Thank you, Maddie. Yeah, I'd love to. I hope to see you in person.
You're coming to Melbourne.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it, man. See you soon.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is. Loving what you're hearing? Make sure you're subscribed here on your favorite podcast app. Or there's even more waiting for you over on YouTube. On our channel, you'll get to see our fascinating guests demonstrate their techniques in real time. You'll see my animated explanation of complex health concepts made simple, plus all of those you had to be there moments that we mentioned in the show. The Coaching with Maddie episodes will be there too. We're also creating exclusive YouTube shorts, quick, powerful health tips you won't find anywhere else. And let's face it, if we're going to be doom scrolling, which we all do from time to time, you might as well make it worthwhile. Just search How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast on YouTube and hit subscribe to unlock the visual side of becoming a healthy friend of the show. Because sometimes you need to see it to believe it, and also to achieve it. The direct link is in the show notes below. Come and join our YouTube community.